Come Again is a 30-episode audio series with science-based information that will get your libido to kick in and your clitoral nerve endings to wake up while also being wildly entertaining. Come Again comes with loads of supplementary material and is intended for both healthcare professionals and the general public. Go to drstryker.com/comeagain for more information. Women who are in the throes of menopause are never thrilled about having hot flashes, but they aren't particularly surprised by them. It's other symptoms that often blindside women, including symptoms that are not often associated with menopause. My guest today is Dr. Makeba Williams, the director of the Center for Health Awareness and Research on Menopause at the University of Illinois College of Medicine, where she's a professor in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology. And at the last Menopause Society meeting, Dr. Williams gave a lecture titled Esoteric Symptoms of Menopause. And that is today's topic. I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, a gynecologist, best-selling author, and a nationally recognized menopause expert. When it comes to menopause, midlife, and what comes after, I'm betting you've not gotten a lot of information from your own doctor. If women are given good information, they'll make good choices. And I'm here to give you the inside information. Esoteric symptoms are different than unusual symptoms. An unusual symptom is something that rarely occurs. An esoteric symptom, on the other hand, is one that occurs commonly, but is rarely discussed and often not well understood. And with that distinction, I want to welcome Dr. Williams to talk about some of those esoteric symptoms that so many women experience during peri and postmenopause. So welcome.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me today.
You know, before we start, I want to talk about your role at the University of Illinois. I mean, this is a new role for you, the director of the Center of Health Awareness and Research on Menopause. It all sounds very impressive, but can you talk a little bit about what exactly you're doing, your research, what's going on there?
Happy to. I have the great pleasure of working with my colleague, Dr. Pauline Mackey, and who serves as the founding director of CHARM. And my role as the clinical director is to bring together the science, the cutting edge technologies, innovations in both medicine and research, and apply that to our patients who are seeking clinical care. We have this really wonderful opportunity being here in the state of Illinois to really address some of the disparate outcomes that we see and the disparate experiences that we see women of Illinois facing as they make this transition to menopause. Some of our research has focused on the differentiated experience that women in urban populations have from those that are in rural populations. And so we want to harness what we know that works well clinically, what we are learning about these different experiences, and apply that to elevate the standard of care for menopausal women.
Yeah. I mean, what's so exciting about your work is that it is so clinically applicable. A lot of times there's research that it's interesting and it's good to know, and we need all that basic science research, but the work that you're doing is really going to make a difference in the lives of so many women.
That's the goal.
Yes, and I'm excited to see what you come up with and see. I'm sure you're going to get a lot of publications out of that too. So we will. I'm already inviting you back to talk about all of that another time. But all right. But so let's talk about today's topic. You know, this whole issue of esoteric symptoms. And let me start by saying I really appreciated that you called your lecture Esoteric Symptoms of Menopause as opposed to Rare Symptoms or Weird Symptoms. So I hope you don't mind that I'm stealing your title for my podcast. But this is my first question before we get into the specific symptoms. Why do you think that so many symptoms that occur commonly and that biologically are estrogen dependent are not necessarily associated with menopause, even by most doctors?
Well, Lauren, I think that reflects this overall lack of knowledge and awareness of menopause in general and the changes that our bodies go through as we make these hormonal shifts. You well know that there has been this gap in clinical knowledge, gap in training and education around menopause. And so what we have done over the years is sort of relegate this menopausal experience to the reproductive organs, if you will. And yet we know that there are estrogen and other hormone receptors throughout the entire body. I would always say to my patients, you know, those estrogen receptors are from the crown of our heads to the soles of our feet and every place in between. But because of this overall lack of knowledge and understanding, we say it can't be menopause if I'm having heart palpitations, or it can't be menopause if you're having joint pain, or if you're experiencing some changes in your mouth during this period. So I think it's overall this lack of knowledge, and maybe we're just not listening to women as well as we could and should be.
And that was a point that you made so well during your lecture about how important it is to validate these symptoms and to listen to women and then hopefully offer some suggestions to make it better. But I think the other thing also is that when someone has hot flashes, you know, yes, there are other causes for hot flashes, but in general, the 51-year-old woman who hasn't had a period for 6 months and is flashing like crazy, that's menopause. But a lot of the symptoms that we're going to talk about, yes, it could be menopause, but it might just be midlife or another medical condition or maybe a medication. And I think that's what makes it a little bit trickier. And as we go through these symptoms from head to toe, you know, I'd like to talk about how much of this is menopause versus some of the other things. And then the other thing that I really want to focus on as we go from head to toe is which of these symptoms are transient, really just perimenopausal, as opposed to the symptoms that are going to be forever symptoms and might even get worse with time. And then, of course, at least try and figure out if ever, estrogen might even help some of these symptoms. Okay, so we're going to start at the head, all right?
Okay.
Before we start with the head, to go head to toe, I want to start with an all over the body symptom, and that's tingling skin. What can you tell us about tingling skin in menopause?
Right. You know, Lauren, I can think of a recent patient that I had who came in and said, I just feel like my skin is crawling. And, you know, initially I was sort of flummoxed by it. But then when you start looking at the literature, you see that a lot of women are having this these sensations of it could feel like bugs crawling on them. And it can be very distressing, especially if, as we just talked about, no one is validating that concern or that symptom. You think it's all in your head when you're feeling this all over your body, if you will.
I think part of the all in your head thing is, let's think about this. When we were in medical school, when we were training, one of the big psychiatric symptoms that we often heard about was this sensation of my skin feels like there's bugs crawling all over it. So immediately that's in our head as a psychiatric problem, as opposed to
Absolutely.
And then results of hormones. Yeah.
And we all also associate that with illicit drug use and opioid use. And so we can sort of, we have this negative connotation. And I think, again, that leads us to not really appreciate that symptom when it is presented by patients. So we know that that is something that many patients experience, whether or not hormone therapy or estrogen can improve the sort of overall response to that remains to be seen. It's one of those symptoms where we see it, can see it commonly, but we don't see this direct correlation where estrogen or other hormonal therapy may improve that symptom.
And is this a temporary perimenopausal thing, or is this something that if someone is experiencing this, it might be a forever thing? Do we know?
It appears to be transient, where we see it more prevalent in women who are making the transition to menopause. And as there is stabilization of some of these hormonal shifts, this sort of erratic period of hormonal change, that many will report their symptoms improve.
Yeah. And I think, and you kind of mentioned this, but I just want to emphasize that there are estrogen receptors in the skin, which cause other changes in the skin beyond that tingling, bug crawling all over your skin feeling. Can you want to mention some of those?
Well, you know, the skin, I don't think we often recognize this or appreciate it, but the skin is our largest organ in the body, and there are receptors throughout. And where we see is that menopause, these hormonal changes can not only change the appearance of the skin, but may also change the function of the skin. We see that we got a change in the skin texture, the moisture of the skin, the skin's ability to retain moisture. So it appears maybe more dry, it can atrophy, lose some of the contour and texture. And then when we look at the function of the skin, we know that the skin can be less apt to heal wounds, loses elasticity. So there is both the function and the appearance of skin that undergoes change as we make it through this menopause transition and into menopause. So losing elasticity as well. So
the easy bruising and all that stuff.
Easy bruising, more wrinkles that appear. We also can see some changes in the coloration of skin. Estrogen is associated with the production of skin pigment or melanin. And over time, we can see some reduction in the pigment producing cells that can lead to this blotchiness or just more of a variegated appearance of the mm-hmm. skin during menopause that can be quite unsettling. Mm-hmm. Additionally, when we think about the change in the ratio of estrogens to the androgens, so are those what hormones that we associate with males, then we can see increased production of oil and sebum that may lead to more acne, which can be quite distressing for those of us who are in midlife. We thought we were done with that in middle school.
Yeah. Yeah. But the other thing I think that's an important differentiation is where the tingling skin seems to be more transient. The thinning dryness and easy bruising, not to mention the wrinkles, are not transient. Those tend to be lifelong and even progressive. And, but also what's interesting, and it's not a reason to take estrogen, but we do have some very good studies that show that systemic estrogen, particularly, and even some local estrogen applied to the face can mitigate some of those changes. So kind of a bigger topic, but I think, again, emphasizing the point that there are estrogen receptors that in this case, at least, potentially can respond to estrogen. All right, staying on the head, let's talk about ears. Nobody ever talks about ears. It's like right there. And there's two symptoms related to estrogen that I came up with that are ear-related. One is ringing and the other is hearing loss. So let's start with ringing in the ears. What's going on there? How common is it? Why does it happen?
Oh, you know, it is fairly common. What we see is that there is this increased prevalence in tinnitus. So that ringing of the ears, it's the ringing, it's the buzzing when there's actually no sound stimulus there. And that we see that there is this increased prevalence in women, particularly when we compare them to men and when we get to this midlife period of time. And it can be quite distressing. The data with regard to whether or not hormone therapy will be beneficial is quite mixed in that there is limited evidence in the various studies that are present. And when we think about the best approach to managing this, it is one to validate that this can be a symptom and thinking about cognitive behavioral therapies rather than relying solely on a hormonal or menopausal treatment. But this is a real symptom that women are experiencing and that can continue throughout the menopausal, perimenopausal period.
So this is not one that's necessarily going to go away when someone is done with perimenopause and firmly postmenopause, that they still might have this?
They still may have these symptoms, in fact, which can be, you know, quite distressing.
Yeah. But there's other things that can cause it too. And I think we really need to emphasize that before people say, okay, I've got ringing in the ears, it's menopause, and there's nothing I can do about it. There are other things that can cause tinnitus beyond hormonal shifts, correct?
Yes, there are. And, you know, and that is being very thoughtful and mindful of, you know, sort of the ear and sound toxicity. These symptoms are also associated with some mood psychiatric disturbances, too. And again, we don't want to create this negative picture of this is all in your head. But it is important to recognize that these ear and hearing changes can be caused by other things.
Yeah. And then hearing loss, a topic that I think we really need to talk about more, because hearing loss is more likely in women than in men. and has a very high association with dementia. So talk to us. What's going on with menopause and hearing loss?
You know, so here it is again, when we look at the overall ear structure and we think about what this sort of hormonal influence, there are receptors for estrogen and hormones that impact those different components like the cochlea, the hair cells, and those pathways that lead to both the perception of sound and then the processing of sound in the brain. There are some studies that would show that prolonged estrogen therapy, more than 5 years, is associated with an increased risk of hearing loss in postmenopausal women. And then there are other studies that show that the influence of estrogen will attenuate this hearing loss that is related to hormone therapy.
When that happens. When you say that.
I mean, yeah, it would be so much easier.
A lot. Estrogen might help and estrogen might hurt.
Right. And so then I think it is important to lean into those strategies of protecting our hearing. And what you brought up is that there is this association of hearing loss with dementia. And so this is an opportune time for us to think about prevention of hearing loss and optimizing hearing overall, getting baseline hearing checks and being mindful of that. And if we are detecting some changes in our abilities to hear, correcting that. So seeing someone in audiology or otolaryngology so that we can address any deficits that may be recognized to prevent, use that as a preventative method or a mechanism to reduce our risk for dementia.
Yeah. So again, not a reason to take estrogen, not a reason to stop your estrogen, but it's important to be screened and then do something about it if there's significant loss. All right.
Absolutely.
We're still on the head here. Moving in. Dry eyes. So the theme is dry. We've got that, right? That pretty much everything we talk about, there's some dryness involved at some level. So let's talk about dry eyes.
Well, you know, let's lean into that a bit. Yeah. So what we know about estrogen is it has a profound effect on our blood vessels. And when we have a loss of estrogen, we can see a diminishing of the prevalence of blood vessels in certain areas. And if we don't have a robust vascular blood vessel system, then we don't have blood flowing through that system. And without blood flowing through those systems, we're not going to have robust lubricated tissues. So that leads to the atrophy of the skin, and it can also impact the function of the eye. And we think about where estrogen is also. So we've got estrogen receptors in the eye, we've got progesterone receptors in the eye, and then we have androgen receptors as well. So the eye system in and of itself is very sensitive to these hormonal changes. And the declines in estrogen can lead to not only a decline in the production of tears, we also see a decline in the oil production. And both those sort of tearing and the oil production help with overall eye function and eye sensation. So we get to that dry eye sensation because of the lack of stimulation of those lacrimal or those tear duct glands, as well as the lack of oil production in other glands. And so this can lead to many, you know, conditions, not only to dry eyes, but there is this blurriness of vision that many will report. Some will report, you know, some changes in the watering of their eye, more irritation, and some sensitivity to light. So this is an area that of the body that I think goes underappreciated and unrecognized. And what is also very striking, Lauren, is that we see this to be dry eyes in particular can be one of those heralding symptoms for women who are undergoing premature menopause or premature ovarian insufficiency. So I counsel my medical students and trainees to be mindful of that. So if you hear of a younger woman who says, I've got some menstrual cycle changes, I'm having dry eyes, and maybe I've got some hot flashes and night sweats, we want our antenna to peek up to say, hey, is this person going through menopause too soon?
Yeah. You know, that's such a good point. And I think one of the ways that we know if something is really a hormone related issue versus aging is to look at young women. Because if you look at women who have a premature ovarian insufficiency, who are, or, you know, premature menopause surgically, who are 30 years old, and then they develop one of these symptoms that we're talking about, I think it's pretty clear that it's not because of aging or another medical condition. And we don't have that kind of research with every one of those these symptoms, but sometimes we do. And it's really helpful as we try and differentiate what's hormones and what's something else. And dry eyes is a tricky one because, again, this is something that we see in women who are not menopausal. So it's always hard to know, is it menopause or is it just midlife kind of thing? And I'm guessing, but I'll ask you anyway, is there any data on the impact of taking systemic estrogen and dry eyes?
You know, the data here, again, is mixed, where we see that some women will note some improvement in their symptoms and others not. And there's going to be a running theme here. If hormone therapy is indicated for hot flashes and night sweats and you're on a systemic therapy, it may help with some of these adjunctive esoteric symptoms that we are speaking about. But for the most part, the data is not there to support us using hormone therapy or estrogen therapy for the improvement of our sort of lubrication in our eyes and maybe other areas in the body.
The other thing also that I'm not sure if that data holds for dry eye, but it holds for a lot of other things, is that a lot of these symptoms are going to be significantly worse in women with vascular disease and specifically diabetes, because as you talked about, one of the reasons this happens is because of decreased blood flow in the smallest vessels, the capillaries. And very often, because we're looking at little parts here, you know, and diabetics very often are at very high risk of small vessel disease, of these vascular problems. So I know in some of these symptoms, it's been documented as being more common in diabetics. I don't know if that's the case for dry eyes, but I suspect it would be. Do you know? Have you ever read anything about that? I don't know if it's been looked at.
I'm not familiar with the data which would suggest that increased prevalence. What we do have data that shows that women over 50 have a double the risk of dry eyes when we compare them to men. And we also know that it is at midlife where we see an inflection point for some of these vascular diseases that you're referring to, diabetes, hypertension, and, you know, the small vessels, so the eyes, the kidneys, you know, the brain, those are what we would say are end organs for vascular disease, right? So it stands to reason that many of these conditions would, in fact, be worse in our patients who have diabetes, who have underlying cardiovascular disease, hypertension, as we see a constriction of those vessels, whether it's because of the diabetes or because of the constriction associated with the pressure, some of these symptoms may in fact be worse.
Listen, there's a lot going on between medical conditions, hormonal changes, and just aging. It's not surprising that we see this kind of stuff, right? All right. Moving down, dry mouth, which is actually something I presented my research at the Menopause Society on dry mouth. The medical term is xerostomia. And this is another one that people don't associate with menopause, but it is. It is very strongly associated with menopause.
Yes. So I often analogize that the tissue in the mouth is very similar to the tissue in the vagina, right?
Exactly, right.
So we will see some changes specifically to the mucosa, so that sort of soft, velvety tissue in our mouth. But we also see that there will be changes to the gums, and the decline in estrogen can, in fact, reduce the production of saliva. And when that happens, we can have some difficulty in just the sensation in the mouth, but it can also make it difficult to swallow, difficult to speak. Our lips can also get drier. And then we may see some changes in the way in which we are perceiving taste. So some changes in taste. So there's this cascade of events that can happen as it relates to dry mouth. And this is one of those areas, though, where we see the use of estrogen. So using systemic estrogen for other indicated causes or symptoms where we might see pretty good improvement in those dry mouth symptoms. And I would say with most of what we're talking about today, we do want to screen that there are no other influencers or causes of these dry mouth symptoms. And specifically as it relates to midlife and menopausal women, as we think about these women who may also have hot flashes and night sweats, and many of those symptoms may be treated by non-hormonal treatments. So things like the SSRIs, the SNRIs, where we use those medications can also cause some symptoms of dry mouth too. So we don't want to just over attribute all of these changes to hormonal changes. We need to do our due diligence. And those listening who may be experiencing these symptoms, push your clinician to do due diligence to rule out other causes or factors for dry mouth and other symptoms.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Because I really think one of the number one thing, other than what you've mentioned, is specifically drugs that are taken for overactive bladder, because that's a very common medication. And boy, does that dry your mouth out. The other thing is women who smoke cannabis. A lot of women are going the cannabis route to deal with insomnia, hot flashes, sexual issues. And there's a lot of problems with smoking, vaping, all of that in terms of cardiovascular and pulmonary. But it also really can contribute to dry mouth. And in addition to all the symptoms you talked about, the difficulty swallowing and speaking, in some people, I mean, there is an association with serious problems like periodontal disease and oral cancer. So some things you just say, okay, I'm going to live with it. This is one that if you do have dry mouth, you need to make sure that you are seeing your dentist frequently and that your dentist is checking for any abnormalities in your mouth, because there are some potentially serious repercussions on that one.
Absolutely.
You know, I just want to mention that we've been at this for about 15 minutes now, and we are about as far from the genitals as you can get. And yet that's what people always think about with menopause symptoms beyond the hot flashes, is they're thinking below the belt stuff. And we're not even close to getting to the vulva and vagina yet. So I just thought I'd throw that out. All right, before we leave the head, last thing I want to mention is the postmenopause face. It's kind of like we talk about Ozempic face. Let's talk about postmenopause face, because beyond the skin changes that you already talked about, you know, the sagging skin and the wrinkles and the discoloration and the extra hair growth and all of that, the other thing that people don't think about that I had never thought about until I happened to be giving a lecture on the topic is what happens to the bony structure on the face and how that impacts. Is that something that you've ever come across or thought about?
You know, where we think about bones, and we think about bones a lot when we approach menopausal, postmenopausal women, and we think about the long bones. We think about the leg bone, the spine, the hips, and the facial bony structure is often overlooked. So what's going on with the bones in general? We know that when estrogen declines, the cells, those what we call osteoblastic cells, those bone building cells decrease, and then we have an increase in the activity in the osteoclast. Those are what I would say are those excavator cells. So they are tearing bone down. So we recognize that that process is going on in those bigger bones, but that same process is going on in our facial bones. Mm-hmm. And so coupled with declines in the collagen and the elasticity of the skin and the reduction in overall sort of muscle plumpness, the resorption of the bones in the face can give us that menopause facies, if you will, where we have this sunkenness to the face. And then if you layer on this, the additional wrinkles and the changes in pigment, all of these together can give you this picture of a classic menopausal face. And we know that estrogen can be quite beneficial for bones, that it, again, it will stimulate those bone building cells. We know that estrogen specifically can be used to prevent bone loss, so to prevent osteopenia, osteoporosis, and we also see that estrogen can help with the plumping of the skin. So it stands to reason that using systemic estrogen would also help with the facial structure and overall facial appearance.
But of course, that study has never been done. And the other study that's never been done and probably never will be done is that women who have been diagnosed with osteoporosis and are taking medication for that, whether it's an oral medication or one of the infusions to build bone in the vulnerable places, like in their hip and their spine, is that also going to change the bony structure in the face? And I think it would be an important study to do, because I think that would be a wonderful incentive for women who are at risk for hip fracture if they knew that if they took their medication that their faces would also look more youthful. I just thought I'd throw that out, but it's never been studied.
Yeah, never been studied, but so important, because there are so many women who are reluctant to use some of those medications because they've heard that if I take that particular drug, it will lead to a sort of weakening, or what we call necrosis, of the jaw bones. And so there's a lot of fear there. Right. And that's keeping many women from using appropriate therapies that would sort of diminish their risk in other areas.
Let's just say it. It doesn't help that every single time a woman goes to the dentist, what's the very first question that she's asked is, you're not taking one of those drugs for osteoporosis, are you? So even if they are, they're terrified. And if they're not, then they're thinking, wow, if that's the first question my dentist is asking me, it sounds pretty dangerous, even though it is a very, very rare side effect. And
very rare.
People who are vulnerable. So just throwing that out there. All right, we got to keep moving down. Otherwise, we're never going to get to like the vagina, right? So let's move down to the neck. The neck, starting with sleep apnea. This is a big one that, again, people are not associating with menopause, but there is an association. So why is that?
Well, we know that overall the rates of sleep apnea increase in midlife. We know that there can also be changes to the, we didn't talk about the vocal cords, but yeah, but there are changes to
we're going
to
get to the vocal cords.
All right. We're going to get there. But there are changes in sort of those functioning pieces that lead to breath and air and oxygen moving. So when we have some increase in weight around our neck and changes in the structures in the nasal passageways, as well as the respiratory pathways, that can lead to increased sleep apnea. And that obstruction over time, we were talking about cardiovascular disease, can also be very damaging, and it can cause more stress on our cardiovascular system as well.
Yeah. You know, the other thing, I actually just read about this, I didn't know this, but we're well aware, of course, that postmenopause there can be reduced muscle tone throughout the body because of estrogen receptors in the muscles. And there's a specific muscle, the genioglossus muscle, that moves the tongue and helps maintain an open airway. And so one of the reasons, in addition to everything that you said about increasing the risk of sleep apnea, is that specifically this muscle doesn't function as well. And so that nice open airway that you want to maintain when you're sleeping becomes potentially problematic. So this
muscle gets a little lazy, right?
Yeah, right. You get a lazy muscle. And we always think of sleep apnea as being overweight, snoring people. Well, that's not always the case. And if you're someone who's just waking up tired and never feeling like you're getting a decent night's sleep, and yes, of course, there's a lot of other reasons for that too. But, and someone also told me, and I've actually never read this, I don't know if you have, but there's a high association with morning headache and sleep apnea in women. Have you ever heard that?
I don't know that I have, but now that you bring it up, it seems reasonable.
You know, someone said it during a lecture, and it's one of those things that I always meant to look it up and I didn't. So I'm glad you weren't sure either, because I'm not sure, but I did hear it someplace. So morning headache, fatigued, worth getting a sleep study to see what's going on. All right, you started talking about the voice change and I interrupted you. So let's circle back and talk about what's going on with your voice.
Yes. So with the voice, there is, again, here are those estrogen receptors, and we see that over time, this decline in estrogen can cause some changes in the vocal range. It is also not only just the decline in estrogen, but it's this change in estrogen relative to the androgen that is continuing to be produced by the ovaries. So testosterone will continue to be produced in menopause as well. We still have production of androgens from the adrenal gland. So these relative changes can lead to an alteration of the range in our voice. And we can see that in, you know, many elite singers, opera singers, that there could be some differences in the way in which they're able to hit notes. But we may also, for those in the general population, I wish I was a singer, but I'm not. But, you know, we can note some changes in how we are intonating, the raspiness or hoarseness of our voice. Now, we also see that many women who are using systemic testosterones and androgens can have some changes in their vocal range, and those are not recoverable. So important to put that message out there that those vocal changes may not recover once those hormonal changes the hormones have been stopped. I'm sorry.
And I think it's also important to mention that a lot of people have this idea that if they're given testosterone, that it's only if they're given too much that they're going to have these vocal changes. And we now have research that shows that even women that are giving an appropriate physiologic doses of testosterone to help with libido, that there can be voice changes, which for some people isn't going to be noticeable. But like you said, if you're an opera singer, if you're a voiceover actor, it can be career ending. So it's huge.
Well, and you know, and it's for those performers, but you know, you think of many women at this stage of life are hitting a peak in their careers, and they may be giving presentations. You may be the teacher in front of a middle school classroom. So it can have tremendous impact to your quality of life and how you are perceived or how you perceive yourself. So one of these quote unquote esoteric symptoms, but can have tremendous impact. And what is really wonderful though, is that, you know, it actually has a name, menopause voice syndrome. We do see that estrogen therapy, whether given intranasally or systemically, can be helpful and beneficial. So for those who have some distress about this, using shared decision-making with your clinician, this may be one of those areas where we would say, consider using estrogen therapy and with or without progestogen, depending on what your uterus situation is, this would be beneficial.
Yeah. But I also want to mention, to build on that, is that you mentioned that people would use an estrogen nose spray, and that's a compounded estrogen. That's not something that you can just go to your doctor and say, hey, I'm concerned about voice changes. Will you prescribe an estrogen nasal spray? It's somewhat specialized. There are centers that do that. And I actually have a podcast on that I did about a year or so back about estrogen and voice changes and how to go about getting one of these estrogen nasal sprays. So I will put that link in the program notes. The other thing I want to mention is this is one of those symptoms that has been studied in young women who go through a premature menopause. So this does seem to be hormone related, not age related.
Yes. I think the data is a little bit tighter and stronger in this area.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on down to the heart.
Palpitations. I'll never forget. I had a patient. This was about 10 years ago. She had had a $1 million cardiovascular workup. And they just could not come up with a diagnosis. And this is after, you know, the wearing heart monitors for weeks. And so what we see for many women is that there is this sensation that my heart is racing, beating a little bit faster. We do see that for many women. I will call this like an atypical vasomotor symptom or an atypical hot flash or night sweats. For some, they don't break out in the heat or the sweat, but it is that fluttering of the heart, the rising heart rate, that can be the sign that many women are having, or a symptom that many women are having in menopause.
Yeah. Half flash of the heart. Yeah.
And, you know, do we have a clear understanding for why they are occurring? No. But again, when we think about the overall physiology of the blood vessels and the role that estrogen plays in both dilating and the restriction or constriction of blood vessels under the decline, with the decline in estrogen, we know that there is this physiologic or functional impact that we see in many areas. So not only in the ability of those blood vessels to carry moisture, but also the function, sort of these palpitations, and then the way in which the heart is responding to its stimuli.
Okay, but here's the thing. If you're a midlife woman and you have been told again and again and again that the number one killer of women is heart disease, and that heart disease increases postmenopause, and then suddenly you've got a fluttering heart, could you give some reassurance as to that these palpitations are generally not an indication of significant cardiovascular disease? Like, how are women going to know? What should they do if they're out of nowhere, new onset palpitations? What's their action step?
Anytime someone has palpitations, because we know that they can be an indicator or harbinger of something serious that could be catastrophic, we want to work it up. So we want you to present to a clinician. You likely will need an EKG. It may require some longer term monitoring. So that could be a monitor that you wear as you go about your normal daily activities. And once that workup has been achieved, we don't want you to despair, because we recognize that these palpitations, these changes can be in fact related to menopause and not be an indicator of something sinister or more serious. But it is incumbent on all of us to make sure that an appropriate diagnostic workup has taken place before we reassure.
Yeah, exactly. And there was actually an article that came out this last year, and I have an analysis of it on my Substack. I'll put that in the program notes. But exactly as you said, they took a large group of women, I don't remember how many, but they hooked them up to a Holter monitor to determine how many of them had true cardiovascular disease as opposed to just perimenopause palpitations. And the overwhelming majority, it was palpitations, but that doesn't mean you can ignore it. You have to make sure you're not in that rare few, that it really does mean something else. But it's scary. It's terrifying.
It is very scary, because we have drilled that into women, and I'm glad that women are paying attention that cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of death for women. And this is the inflection point in midlife where we see increasing cardiovascular disease. And we don't want to overly scare women. So get the workup. And if the workup is negative, and reassuring, then one can actually consider hormone therapy if it is appropriate for the other symptoms one may be having.
Yeah. And also, this is a perimenopausal symptom. This is not a forever symptom. This, like, the kind of like hot flashes, you know, the hot flash of the heart concept is, this is something that as your body accommodates to life without estrogen, it figures it out and it stops happening. So there's,
and I think that's important to point out. The menopause transition is a time of hormonal fluctuation. It's like going on a roller coaster. But once things smooth out, the body can acclimate and respond in a more stable way, if you will. So these, many of these symptoms are going to be transient. And so we need not despair.
Yeah. Except sometimes transient could be a little more transient. I'm just saying, you know, like hot flashes, everyone thinks, oh, it's just going to be a couple of years. And the average is, you know, 7 years, 10 years, if you're Black. I mean, it's just, it's not, when we say transient, what we mean is it's not
right,
like,
right.
It's not necessarily like, oh, here today, gone tomorrow. I wish it would be.
But
nice.
It can be a long ride, a long road. Some roller coaster
and I don't
rides
like roller
are
coasters,
shorter than others,
right? All right. Moving down. the gastrointestinal system, which actually starts higher up in the esophagus with reflux and all. And I just published an article on my Substack looking at all these GI symptoms. So I don't want to talk a lot about it because I'm going to put that link in, talking about, you know, reflux and bloating and even your bowel movements changing. But what I want to know from you is, you know, you're out there in the world, both urban women and rural women. How often do you hear about the GI symptoms, and does it seem to be any different whether someone's in the city and eating processed crummy food versus in the, I'm making a sweeping generalization here, which is probably inappropriate, that women who are in the heartland are eating better. But no, seriously, what do you hear out there?
I hear that this is a problem for all comers. So it is, you know, it's really striking to me the number of patients that I see on any given day who are complaining of GI symptoms. And I will tell you just, you know, personal experience, when my mother was going through perimenopause, she was like, there is something going on with my GI system. I can't eat certain foods anymore. And I thought that I've not read that in a textbook. Mom, you must, you know, you must be making this up. And so I feel like this is my mea culpa to my mother, where in fact, we are seeing numerous women who complain of changes in taste, changes in tolerability of certain foods, and overall a change in how the sort of filtered waste is moving throughout the GI tract. So we want to validate this for women. We also, there's this emerging literature that there are changes in the what we call the microbiome. So the balance of bacteria in our gastrointestinal system under the influence of these hormonal changes that can make it challenging as women go through this time period. And I think one of the best examples of that sort of points to this hormonal influence is what happens in pregnancy. Mm-hmm. We know that the changes in estrogen and progestogens can influence the esophagus. So it is more relaxed under the influence of progesterone. And this is why we get more reflux in pregnant women. We also see that there is a slower transit of food and waste through the GI system under those changing hormonal influences. So, you know, it stands to reason that women will also complain of these changes. So GERD, and maybe it's altered constipation and diarrhea as they make their way through the menopause transition.
And unfortunately, from the data that we do have, which isn't terrific, but the data that we do have shows that hormone therapy can actually make GERD worse. So, yes. You know, it's not the solution there. The other thing that strikes me as I was writing about the gastrointestinal stuff is most women that have these symptoms, they're not going to a gynecologist. They're going to see a gastroenterologist. And most of them really are not aware of these changes. So in my Substack, I will put in the program notes, I'm going to put the link to my Substack that gives the articles that are relevant, because sometimes you just have to share some articles with your doctor to say, hey, this isn't something that a lot of gastroenterologists know about, but there is some new research on the impact of hormones and, as you said, the microbiome and how your bowel functions. So interesting stuff. All right. Arthritis, joint pain, go.
Arthritis in the joints. So here again, we see those receptors for hormones in our joints, and we've talked about them being in the bones. On any given day, we will hear more complaints about joint pain and stiffness than we will hear about hot flashes and night sweats. And this is how I've heard it from my patients. You know, I woke up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom and I found myself hobbling, or I can no longer spring out of bed. I feel like I have to get a can of WD-40 and lubricate or oil my joints. I've got to wind up to those activities that I used to be able to do. And what we see is that when we start women on hormone therapy for hot flashes and night sweats, we will often see that those joint pains, so those muscle pains, may actually improve. And it is really wonderful to see that improvement because when you are unable to move as you previously moved, that can be quite distressing. And I think it's really important that we pay attention to these symptoms because this is a critical period of time where we need more movement because of some of the metabolic changes that are occurring. So we need to alleviate those pains that may be keeping women sedentary and grounded. So we want to validate for women that joint pain, back pain, arthritic pain are prevalent. Very prevalent during this menopause transition.
And continues. And in fact, when we look at reasons why women continue to take hormone therapy long term, one of the things on that list is joint pain, because we
Yes.
know that if you go off your hormone therapy, the joint pain will come back. And as you said, that's huge, and frozen shoulder and a lot of other issues with that. So that's another thing, that it's not just inconvenient, it can really have a huge impact on frailty, on falling down, on fracture. If someone has osteoporosis, we're not even going to talk about that because that's one of the more commonly discussed, and I think people are very familiar with that. But in the last little bit of time we have left, I do want to talk about the vulva, the vagina, and the bladder. And it doesn't really go under the heading of esoteric symptoms because, along with hot flashes, we do hopefully hear a lot more people who are addressing some of these genital changes. But the reason why I think it's important to bring it up is that, first of all, these genital urinary syndrome of menopause, which is, of course, all of the changes that occur as a from a lack of estrogen in the vagina, the vulva, and the bladder, that doesn't always happen simultaneous with the onset of menopause and hot flashes. It can be remote. Some people don't even have these symptoms until 10 years later. And then they don't even realize that it's a menopause thing because it doesn't happen the same time as other menopause symptoms. And they think it's just aging, you know? And I just always want to take that opportunity to throw out, yeah, that is menopause, and you can start local estrogen or DHEA therapy, whatever you're doing, at any time. But talk about the bladder symptoms some, because while people are very familiar with genital urinary syndrome and menopause and vaginal dryness and sexual pain, can you just throw something in there about that poor, forgotten bladder and the impact that it has throughout life when you're out of estrogen?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, with estrogen receptors being located in the urethra, which is the tube through which urine travels, it doesn't close as tightly. So, women can have the sensation that they have to go to the bathroom more often, or they will actually leak urine. Estrogen receptors are also in the bladder tissue itself. The bladder is a muscle, and we've already talked about declining muscle mass in other areas. So we can see that loss of mass of muscle in the bladder as well, where we can get some prolapse of the tissue. Couple that with the prolapse in the vaginal tissue, and you have this whole combination that makes the overall urinary tract function dysfunctional during this time period in life.
But beyond that urgency and that gotta go feeling and the muscles that are not functioning as well, we've also got recurrent urinary tract infections.
So, estrogen is an important regulator of the acid-base balance of the vagina, and it also impacts the thickness of the wall between the bladder and the vagina. So, once we get an overgrowth of bacteria in the vagina and we have a thin wall separating it, and a urethra that doesn't close as tightly, that's hanging out closer in the vagina, we can have those little bacteria that go up the urethra. But also, because of that thin wall, that bacteria can transcend that thin wall and lead to this recurrent urinary tract infection phenomenon.
And how crazy does it make you that all these women are being given antibiotic after antibiotic after antibiotic, and then they're sent for a cystoscopy, and all they need is a little estrogen love in their vulva, vagina, and urethra, and all of a sudden those recurrent urinary tract infections are either going to, quite frankly, disappear altogether or at least be significantly reduced.
A million-dollar workup that could have been cured with some local estrogen to the vagina.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, of all of the things we've talked about, I think that's the thing which is really the most problematic, because it happens to so many women and it's just terrible, these recurrent urinary tract infections. And it's just like the easiest thing to fix. I mean, every single woman should be told this proactively. If this happens, if you start to have recurrent urinary tract infections, yes, the urgency and all of that. But so many women have this idea that using a local vaginal estrogen or DHEA is just for sexual problems, and it's not. It's also for these urinary problems that are so common in older populations. You know, there's more adult diapers being sold now than baby diapers. I mean, what's wrong with that picture? So,
well, and they've gotten fancier too, right?
Very fancy.
It's an exploitation of the market. And again, we could stem a lot of the sales of those products and the sort of financial economic impact that it has to women if there was greater recognition that locally applied estrogen to the vagina not only helps with the vaginal tissue, the vulvar tissue, but how your bladder functions.
Yeah. And while we're on the topic of applying estrogen to the vulva and the vagina, and this is part of the vulva, but be sure and go north and put a little bit of estrogen directly on the urethra, because that really helps in terms of those tissues and that urgency. And then keep going north and put it on your clitoris, because of course I am obligated to at least mention that part of genital urinary syndrome of menopause is a clitoral atrophy, which in some women can result in difficulty with orgasm. And of course, that's the topic of many episodes in Come Again. So I'm not going to get into that now, other than to say that that is certainly one of the most esoteric symptoms of menopause, because even doctors that talk about genital urinary syndrome of menopause rarely mention the impact on the clitoris and the impact that that can have on someone's sexual function. So just had to throw that out. All right. What did we miss? We didn't say anything about the feet or the toes. I have nothing to say about that. Do you?
No, I can't
I
think.
I feel like we should go keep going, you know.
The soles of the feet can certainly, you know, hurt. And we know that there can maybe be more laxity in the bony structures of the feet, but I don't have any good data.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Is there any, there's other parts, obviously, we couldn't cover it all, but is there anything that you really want to talk about that I didn't mention?
Well, Lauren, what I would say is we've talked about a lot of different organ systems that, and you brought this up at the beginning of the podcast, the reason why many of these symptoms are not recognized as menopausal symptoms is because there can be other factors and influencers. And so as we approach menopause, the menopause transition, these esoteric symptoms, we have to have what we call a multidisciplinary approach. Mm-hmm. And I want to impress upon listeners, you have to recognize what your symptoms are and advocate, because there may be other providers who you are seeing who don't recognize these symptoms. So you have to advocate for yourself. You may have to educate some of the clinicians and providers that are in your life so that we can make sure that you are getting appropriate treatment. We don't want to overly dismiss or attribute symptoms to menopause, nor do we want to under-recognize where menopause and hormonal changes are at play. So this
it's
opportunity.
Very difficult. You know, you don't want to chalk this all up to aging, but you don't want to chalk it all up to menopause either. These are all, for the most part, multifactorial symptoms. It's complicated.
Yes.
And we could go on and on about the fact that most physicians and other advanced practice nurses, et cetera, no one has the time to sit there and really do this deep dive. And unfortunately, the onus does fall to the woman to say, could this be menopause? Is this midlife? Is it medication? Is it something else, in terms of trying to figure out what your best options are to at least decrease the symptoms? All right, before we finish, one question which you may not be able to answer yet, that at the very beginning, we were talking about the work that you're doing in terms of rural versus urban women and menopause symptoms. Can you give us a sneak preview of what that research is showing, or do I just have to wait and have you back another time?
Well, we can give you a sneak preview. It is what we see in rural women. Many of them are complaining more of psychosomatic symptoms. So, you know, sort of more mood changes, and their symptoms, while they will often complain of hot flashes and night sweats, those aren't necessarily the most concerning symptoms. And where they like to get information is also different. And so we've got to figure out, how do we tailor information? How do we educate women where they are and in ways that speak to them and their unique experiences?
I have so many questions about that, but I'm going to just hold on to those questions for another day when I have more time, because I think that's fascinating, looking at the different experience of urban versus rural women. And it's just yet another indication that every woman's menopause is her menopause. It is individual, and that's why we can't treat all women the same. So with that, I want to thank you. Thank you. Thank you for this time. And I'm so excited. You're new to University of Illinois. I was so excited when I heard you were coming to my neck of the woods and working with our mutual friend and colleague, Dr. Pauline Mackey, who also has done a number of podcasts. So I know you all know who she is. And she's new on Instagram. Have you noticed that? She's now suddenly, that took some pushing, you know, but people love her because she gives such good information. So, but thank you for your